Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am dandy.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, we are going to look at flip sides of the AI coin. On the positive side, right, you've got a story in the New York Times about animation startup Toonstar, which utilizes AI throughout the creative process, from honing storylines to generating imagery to dubbing for overseas audiences. But the big advantage for the company of AI has come from tools allowing animation lip syncing to be done 80 to 90% faster, you know, to make sure that the drawings match the words that are coming out of the mouth, right? It's always complicated. The Times reports that lip syncing a minute of dialogue and animation used to take upwards of 4 hours. With these tools, they can do it in 15 minutes. Pretty cool. Computers have come, have long been a boon for animators, of course, right? Traditional hand-drawn animated series can take months from inception to airing. That's why shows like The Simpsons could never really be truly timely. But even as early as the late 1990s, shows like South Park were playing with computers and rapidly reducing turnaround times. The Comedy Central cartoon famously shoots episodes in the span of a week or so, which allows for a level of timeliness and commentary that is simply unthinkable for most animated programs. So this is the upside of AI, right? It's a tool that will allow the flourishing of creativity. And while we can get into tricky debates about how these things are trained and the property rights of those who have had their work stolen to have it trained on, I get, you know, that ship has kind of sailed. I assume it'll all get worked out in the courts, whatever. Here's the downside of AI. Here's the flip side of that coin. 404 Media reported last week on a pretty funny story about a summer book preview published by the Chicago Sun-Times, among other news outlets, in which more than half of the books, such as a hot new novel from best-selling writer Andy Weir, simply did not exist. The author of the guide immediately copped to having used AI to generate the list, which he then did not check for accuracy, and which was then sent out by his syndication company, who did not check the thing for accuracy. And it was published by papers again, like the Chicago Sun-Times, which also did not check it for accuracy. I cannot emphasize this enough. Just totally made up books. The AI, the large language model, just generated things that did not exist for this list. You know, again, on the one hand, that's kind of funny, kind of a funny story. I mean, not for this guy, he got fired, but, you know, that whatever, that's them's the breaks. On the other, though, it's a real sign of how AI is actually being used in the real world by lots of people, right? It's a substitute for thought. It's a means of doing something quickly rather than doing it well. It's like the college students who literally cannot read a book and then use AI to write essays about the books they can't read and then get frustrated when their professors call them out for cheating. Unlike some folks at the Bulwark, this strikes me as an incredibly bad thing. I don't know. We aren't just outsourcing work to robots. We're outsourcing how to think to robots. And as Agent Smith said to Morpheus about life before the Matrix was redesigned to this the peak of your civilization. I say your civilization because as soon as we started thinking for you, it really became our civilization. Peter, are you excited for the robot civilization?
Yeah, there's a new Andy Weir book in the robot civilization. I guess that's probably written by AI, and I'm an Andy Weir fan, right? That's going to be great. Like, so if the robots have the new Andy Weir book before us, then I'm on the side of the robots. It's a problem that these things hallucinate. It's a problem that people are using these things without checking for hallucinations in venues and forums in which factual accuracy is really important. I would actually say that, like, this is a notable but actually not very important example. No one is particularly harmed by this. Yes, it's a totally... Hold on. It's totally a fireable offense. It is absolutely the sort of thing that you should not do as a journalist. It is not in any way okay. So to be clear, I'm not giving this my blessing. I'm saying that people who are reading these best books list, books to read for the summer or whatever type lists in a Chicago newspaper, you know what they're going to do? They're going to go, maybe one or two of them look like things that they want to read. They're going to go search for them on Google or Amazon or whatever it is that maybe they're even going to go to a real bookstore. They're going to look for these books and they're going to find out they're not there because they don't exist. And that is the extent of the harm there. It's not great. It's not, right? But like...
Well, I mean, I think the people who are materially harmed are the people who do have books coming out this summer and potentially lost out on book sales because of it.
Sure, though that depends. I mean, that assumes that these things drive significant book sales, that people even read books anymore. As Sunny said, the English majors can't read books. So, you know, that ship has sailed. The actual worst problem that is the same thing, but does have real harms, is that we're pretty consistently, it's maybe not quite every week, though I would not be surprised if it is equivalent of every week, seeing reports of lawyers filing briefs that are entirely AI generated, in which those briefs cite cases that don't exist. And when this stuff starts to get into your legal system and it's not being checked by lawyers, and in most cases, it seems like the judges are throwing this stuff out, recognizing it for the kind of the garbage that it is, like, that is a direct and real, like, if you want to use an example that's like, this is a real problem, I think that's a much bigger problem. I let's not say that there's no harm, but the harm from this summer books thing is pretty minimal. It's just not but there are real harms that come from these hallucinations. This is happening with this is happening also with papers that academics are publishing, where they're just they're letting the AI write it, and the information that they're not checking it, and the information in the paper is referencing, say, some other paper that does not exist. That sort of thing, when you're supposed to be kind of contributing to the body of human knowledge, when it's infecting the legal system, that is a much bigger problem, and it's related to this. And so this, I think, is a sort of silly example that we can talk about, but like, the hallucination issue is real, but we have a solve for this, which is check your work. That has always been the solve for journalism, for academia, for the legal field. You are expected to do your job and check your work. That hasn't changed just because ChatGPT can do some of it and perhaps provide a rough draft for you that you should be checking.
It's interesting that you say that there's no material harm done, because yes, it's not like anybody has died as a result of this. This guy didn't write a medical paper that recommended giving people with anaphylactic shock, I don't know, something that would harm them if they took it, right? But like, to say that no one is harmed by this is, first of all, the publishing company was harmed. They were functionally stolen from. The labor was not performed. The readers were all harmed because, again, they were given something that just wasn't real. They were given a thing that didn't exist. We could get into weird questions of labor value theory here or whatever. But somebody who is harmed is a person who would have done this job for real and can't get it because there are people churning out 60-page inserts full of hallucinated AI crap because they do it quickly and they do it cheaply.
Horse and buggy drivers were in trouble when the taxi cabs came along.
But this is not the same thing, Peter. It's not the same thing
right.
at all.
I mean, like,
and
the hallucination is worse than the original, right? Like, the car is obviously an improvement on a horse-drawn carriage, but being fed like ersatz slop that doesn't get you information that you would actually like to have is worse.
So once again, I think this is not okay and a fireable offense, and I in no way am justifying doing what this writer did, because it's not in any way okay. What I'm saying is the grand social harm here from this specific example is much smaller than some of the other things where you see hallucinations. But the hallucination problem is, first of all, it's getting less bad.
I'm not actually sure that's true, Peter. Like, there's been a bunch of reporting about how the newest models of a bunch of these things are actually hallucinating like worse and more frequently, in part because they're becoming sort of self-referential in ways that encourage that. So I think that...
That may be true with some of the models. This is not what I have read. We probably don't have the expert... Like, it's actually probably quite difficult to measure, and there's probably competing theories about this, but...
I have a theory. It's all bad.
Yeah,
how about that?
Yeah.
There's a theory
but,
for you.
But, like, I really don't think we can just sort of universally say that, like, this is a problem that's being solved. And, you know, I think even more broadly, I think Sunny has articulated a really good distinction for sort of when to worry about this and when not to, right? And to a certain extent, when to worry about it is the human use case, when people are using it to substitute for thought. It makes a ton of sense if you can use AI to make your existing work, to take sort of the scut work out of your task, right? Like, if you can execute on your thoughts more quickly and efficiently and at a higher level. But when you're using this stuff to substitute for thought, having to slog through a ton of garbage non-information is in and of itself sort of a societal harm. And I think that humans who participate in that you know, in that shift, sort of in ways large and small, are making everything sort of dumber and faker and lower quality. And so it doesn't make a ton of sense to me to isolate. You know, there are obviously, there's a range of harms, but everyone who is just refusing to think and assuming that it's okay for the world to get sort of faker and crappier and for there to be more time involved in weeding that out is contributing to making the world a lot worse.
Look, it's obviously not great that there's a bunch of fake information out there, but there's been a bunch of fake information out there on the web for a long time. There's also been a bunch of fake information out there not on the web long before the web existed. And to a pretty large degree, like, I feel like your complaints could be almost perfectly translated back onto 1998 and what a lot of academics and journalists were saying about the internet. None of this stuff is fact-checked. All of this stuff is totally unsupervised. You know, the rule, as we recall from high school, was that you absolutely could not cite anything from online, you know, in your research papers or anything like that, right? Because it was totally unreliable, and who knew whether it was true? Wikipedia, in particular, was the absolute worst, and that stuff worked itself out for the most. It was true at the time, right? There was a huge
no, but has it really though? Because if I'm reading an essay or a story and I see somebody references Wikipedia as their source for something, I am immediately discounting it, because like the thing about Wikipedia is that it has its uses. What it does is it collects links that you can then click through to read to ensure, like, okay, Wikipedia says this. Well, where's the story from? All right, the New York Times reports, or like the CIA World Factbook says, you know, whatever. Like, I understand Wikipedia has its uses, but if anybody were to cite Wikipedia in as an authoritative resource in any way other than in a discussion of whether or not Wikipedia is an authoritative source, like, that's an instant red flag for me. You're right, this problem has existed since 1998. And it has not gotten solved, and it's getting worse. It is, the LLMs are making it worse.
See, I just feel like there's more access to true information much more quickly than ever. That was true. The web made it faster than it was before the web. The development further of like the everything moving online, newspapers and you know, PDFs and of academic papers and you know, think tank white papers, that sort of thing, moving online, just made information so much easier to access. You read stories about journalists, you know, from the 1980s or 1990s who did policy journalism or reported on government offices, and they just had to drive around town a lot of the time to like go physically pick up papers, which was just so much slower a process to get to learn or find out anything. And what ChatGPT and sort of similar LLM type things are, if you use them correctly, they are quick guides. They are great quick research guides. They are not infallible. Neither were the research assistants that a lot of columnists and you know, academics and people like that, sort of high level information specialists, have used in the past. You would get these reports produced by smart 24, 25 year olds who, in many cases, were either making flat out mistakes and probably weren't just totally hallucinating things, but were making mistakes, were sort of leaving out crucial context, right? Like, and then you, as the expert, had to go through and check a bunch of that. But what it did was it sort of provided you a quick guide that was much faster. That's the same thing that Wikipedia does. And this, again, what I was saying with Wikipedia is it's not that people just cite Wikipedia and that's that. And that's what worked itself out, is that now there is a kind of general cultural and social understanding about what Wikipedia is good at and what it isn't good at. And in fact, it's, if you're just trying to learn the gist of something, it's often the best first place to start. That doesn't mean that there's no fact errors on Wikipedia, but that's true of every information source. The most reliable information source in the world still has fact errors. And what you do is you correct them and you learn sort of how to use this stuff. And there becomes a kind of social understanding for how this stuff is, like, for, you know, social and professional, right, within the kind of knowledge curation, like, industries. Like, we have totally different standards now than we did 25 years ago, in part because we've learned how to deal with this stuff.
Peter, so as someone who reads, like, literally hundreds of thousands of emails from sort of non-professionals a year, I can absolutely assure you that the sort of social and cultural rules about like what to cite, that doesn't exist. That's not Like, that is not a generally accepted rule in the general public. It's just not.
I mean, the amount of stuff
that I get that cites Wikipedia, that cites like totally dubious sources, that may be a like highly elite consensus. It is not a general one.
And this is the thing that I think that I just want to emphasize here, Alyssa, because the problem is not that large language models exist. The problem is not even that they are occasionally used by people to punch up their writing or whatever, right? The problem is that they are being used wholesale as substitutes for like whatever the assigned task is. Like this guy's assignment was put together, amongst other things, was put together a list of the best books that are coming. And what he did was he typed into ChatGPT or something, hey, what are the 20 best books coming out this summer? And it spit out a bunch of nonsense and everybody just ran with it. And like, again, there are fact-checking things that broke down here and there are responsibilities that broke down or whatever. But like, I think that this is happening on a large scale in realms we don't see, except for when like a teacher complains about it in an essay in the Chronicle of Higher Education or somewhere else. And I think it is becoming socially accepted to do it. And that's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just much less concerned about this. There's going to be issues. There's always hiccups and frustrations when new technologies arrive. And I feel like I am already seeing, at least amongst sort of information professionals, like a rough, not certainly not like whole or complete, but a rough consensus starting to develop on how to use these things. And some sort of like vague sense of it's totally imperfect, but there's like, it's not going to just be like, well, we have the rules today, but, because these things are changing all the time.
But we're talking about two totally separate things, Peter. Like, information professionals and like everybody else are just, they're distinct categories.
Do you think that in 1985 people had just like, they really had good information sourcing, like reliable, like before LLMs and the internet? Do you think that people just like, man, that your average person who is writing a letter to a newspaper, they just like, they're on top of it? Do you think that
in 1985 Cletus didn't have access to Twitter to tell everybody in the world his fucking thoughts?
I think there's sort of a category error here, Peter. Like, what we're talking about is, what Sunny and I are talking about is the sort of substitution of human thought for like pressing a button or writing a simple prompt. And I agree that there's much more high quality information available. Like, I will say I get a lot of letters. I mean, I also just want to speak as someone who was doing like serious historical and policy research as a teenager, right? Like, I did both National History Day. I was a nationally ranked competitive policy debater. And so I think you are absolutely correct that like the availability of high quality information is much, 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 much higher. At the same time, I think part of the problem with LLMs and with the internet has been that there is a tendency not to use the stuff that's available. I don't think that there's necessarily like much more widespread understanding about like how you use like NIH databases to pull up papers or PubMed or Google Scholar, all of which is stuff that I use all of the time. Like, I have spent enormous amounts of time in like public and private archives, and like, yeah, it's like, it is amazing what Chronicling America makes available, you know, with the push of a button. Chronicling America is the big Library of Congress database of historical newspapers. And it's like, it's incredible. At the same time, there is a problem if the zone for non-professionals is so flooded with garbage that the real stuff doesn't have a chance to compete. And, you know, if people's relative sort of research skills are what they were 40 years ago, and there's more available, but more of it is just like completely fake, I do think that's really challenging. Like, I see the range, you know, I judge at National History Day, and I see the range of what kids are sort of availing themselves of. And, you know, like, the gaps are really big. And so, yeah, I think there is like, look, I play around with LLMs a fair amount. Like, I think they're interesting. I've used them to analyze sort of big data sets you know, I think they are an interesting, potentially transformative technology. But I think the idea that, you know, we are at a place where we're close to the social norms, you know, having developed, or those social norms being accepted, or, you know, people having sort of much higher media literacy than they did 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 40 years ago. I am not as confident as you about those norms developing.
I actually believe that over time, 10, 15 years from now, it's hard to predict the future, but I actually believe that over time, it's not just that the norms are going to develop, it is that AI itself is going to get better at filtering this stuff. And people who are maybe not research or information professionals are going to be able to use AI because it's going to actually weed out the garbage, which is one thing that AI is really good at, which is just sorting through a lot of information quickly and making determinations in a way that is, if not always perfectly correct, as we know, if definitely not always perfectly correct, is frequently better than all but right now, all but the very best humans doing the same task.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I hope that that's true. And I mean, full disclosure, the Washington Post has a deal with OpenAI to sort of surface stuff from us sort of higher up in queries. And I think you're going to see a certain amount of journalism actually getting subsidized by some of these big companies, in part because they need new facts and material to train their models on. But I don't know. I really think, Peter, that you're maybe extrapolating from sort of more elite behavior to a general population in a way that I'm just not sure is supportable.
I just want to, like, if you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine an AI stomping on the face of another AI until it gets its facts right, and somebody on the couch with their beer hat on, sucking the tubes that bring them their sustenance, says, yeah, I guess this is right. Sure. Why not? Why not? Why isn't this set of facts right? Sure. I am skeptical. I'm skeptical, Peter, but we'll see. Exit question here. Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that the entity is going to destroy us all? Peter. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. This is actually for the review part of the thing, because we're gonna mix our segments up a little bit here.
Am I answering this question?
Yes.
I think it's absolutely awesome and not in any way controversial that the entity is going to make movie making 90% cheaper if you're doing animation, and probably if you're doing stuff that's increasingly doesn't look like animation but kind of is, and it's gonna be great. Like, your people, the next wave of new filmmakers are gonna come up on YouTube, and they're gonna be able to do stuff that people that, like, big studios used to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on, and they're gonna be able to do it for cheap and for budgets that, like, you couldn't even think about doing it on. And it's gonna unleash the creativity of the next generation of animators in particular.
Melissa.
It's bad to outsource your brain to the machines.
Horse and buggy comparison is right for the animators and the lip syncing, right? Yeah. Like, this is like using computer tools to streamline the process is good, right? Like, that's a thing we can largely agree on.
Yes.
And I feel bad for the animators who may lose their jobs, but, you know, like, but I think Peter, frankly, having known a lot of people in my time, having known more than just the elites on this show and the listeners, the great elite listeners of this show, having known a lot of, like, normal people, I am terrified for what the future holds when people just, like, put garbage prompts into AI and then come back with whatever facts, like, well, the Grok told me this. Like, that's a nightmare. That's a nightmare scenario, and we're hurtling right towards it. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our on Friday for our bonus episode on what we've lost by letting video game movies get respectable. It's a real problem. And now on to the main event. Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning. This is a hard movie to summarize, in part because writer-director Christopher McQuarrie and producer-auteur Tom Cruise attempt to do something very audacious with this movie, which is essentially to retcon the whole series, which is comprised of a group of movies that are more or less standalone pictures. You know, there's some continuity between them, but these were mostly standalone movies, into a coherent and compelling, unified, unitary story. But I'll give it a shot. Following the events of Dead Reckoning, in which an artificial intelligence program known as the Entity wanted to obtain a key that would ensure it could never be destroyed, more or less. The world has collapsed into chaos as the AI has both destroyed the ability to understand truth by rewriting the past to control the present, while also infiltrating every nuclear power's mainframes to take control of their arsenals. Its endgame is to destroy humanity while secreting itself away in a shielded server farm database, all the while using humanity's own distrustful nature to ensure that the world's nations cannot join forces to stop it. Okay, that's the plot of the movie, as we typically describe plots. The real plot of the movie is stuff happens so Tom Cruise can do stunts. And that's been true of all of these movies, certainly at least since the third one. The stunts in this movie are pretty impressive, right? There's an extended underwater sequence that will be a nightmare for anyone with a natural terror of cave diving, followed by an extended sequence where Tom Cruise hangs off a biplane and then flies a biplane and then crashes the biplane into another biplane. Again, biplanes. Who knew? Anyway, that's more or less what's going on in this movie. But even then, I don't think that's what this movie is really about. The movie, and indeed this franchise as a whole, is really about growing up in the digital age. The Mission Impossible franchise is the first film series of the internet era, really. The first film series that both grew up with the internet and was concerned with and by the internet. We go back to the very first one, right? The first one has a whole sequence about the difficulties of using email and Usenet. And had this very, it's got this very funny sequence where he emails Max at Job 314 or something, right? Like Job 314 being the domain name that he's sending it to. Again, it's just very funny.
It has a colon in it, because definitely domain names in 1995 could support colons.
That's how they work. That's absolutely how they work. But the series has evolved, right? It's escalated beyond that. And really, this final entry is about the idea of large language models and AI programs in general, and how they are threatening our very idea of verifiable truth. Here's one way to think about it. Here's just one way to think about, again, how this series has grown and how the world has grown. When the series began, fewer than 20% of Americans, and an even smaller percentage of users around the world, it was like half that around the world, were online. As the series comes to its conclusion, virtually everybody in the world is walking into the movie theater to see it with a supercomputer in their pocket. Like, things have changed. Things have really gotten different. The Final Reckoning, indeed the whole series, is about Tom Cruise as the final analog movie star in an increasingly digital world. It's why he has an almost fetishistic desire to do his own stunts, from hanging off airplanes to hanging off the Burj Khalifa to hanging off of helicopters. It's all thrilling, but it's only thrilling because we know he is actually there, or at least often actually there. He's jumping out of airplanes. He's jumping off of mountains. He is real and corporeal. And while there are some digital manipulations, of course, to erase safety gear and do that sort of thing, it's very much a physical thing we're seeing. It's real. Tom Cruise is the last of the real. I dug The Final Reckoning, including the first hour, which a lot of critics have really been kind of savaging. And I could nitpick all sorts of stuff. There's no reason. This movie is too long. It does not need to be 3 hours long. But it never felt overly long, because every performance is just bang on perfect from the leads on down. I want to give special shout out to Severance's Trammell Tillman, who plays the submarine captain, with a sort of understated comedy that just about brought the house down. I was watching it with, like, every time he was on screen, people started laughing. It was great. Just perfect performance. Alyssa, what did you make of Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning?
I think it's extremely funny that it's a movie about how our woke diverse military is great. Hannah Waddingham is totally wasted as, like, a Navy admiral in charge of an aircraft carrier. Like, there's a lot of wasted acting in this movie. Like, Nick Offerman has four lines in this movie and exists to, like, have a death scene that's, like, probably the worst thing in the movie. I mean, look, I think my basic feeling about this is what you are describing, Sonny, is, like, much more compelling than what we actually see on screen. And I think my feelings about this movie can best be described by a joke that I've seen a lot of people make, which is that, like, if the script for this movie had been written by an AI trained on the previous Mission Impossible movies, like, I think this would be a totally plausible outcome for this LLM, right? It's like, if you just, like, watch these movies, write a sequel, bring back some surprising cameos, but like not anyone who's dead. You know, do like include a lot of sort of redos of like the knife falling on the computer table in the Black Vault. Like, this is exactly what the LLM would churn out. And look, these movies have existed as sort of vehicles for stunts for a long time, and this one feels particularly vehicle-y for stunty stuff. And I think, you know, look, I think the first movie in this franchise is awesome. There are a number of other very good ones. This franchise had been wearing thin for me, definitely by the last movie. I don't find Hayley Atwell's Pickpocket particularly compelling in this. I don't find its depiction of sort of the AI takeover particularly scary or interesting, especially at a time when like we actually do appear to have a bunch of AI sort of adjacent real world cults who are murdering people. Like, you could have made that aspect of the movie sort of much scarier and more interesting. It's like, it's okay, but I think the version of the movie that you would have written, Sonny, is just like a lot more interesting than what we actually get. Also, I really like, I don't think you can actually like, you know, charmingly snuggle someone in a gamma bag when you haven't been experiencing like weird depressurization symptoms. I think that would be bad for you. That's just a side.
Wait, it's not realistic? All right, I gotta think about this for a minute before I give my review now.
Do you think, can you imagine just like how much actual like weird skin damage Tom Cruise would have from being like frozen in that water? He would be like, he would look so gross. But that's a side note. That's me having reread Into Thin Air too recently, and therefore like thinking a lot about depressurization, like pressurization sickness and frostbite and stuff.
He looks so polished and fresh in this film. Right?
Just, well, like, he's a little puffy around the face. Like,
I would say these last two movies, the first ones where he's starting to look old. You know, he's an old guy. He's 63 or something. He's getting up there.
He's an exceptionally well maintained 63-year-old. Yeah, I mean, the only moments in this movie that I actually felt some sort of emotional connection is like the stuff with Luther, right? Like, that's, you know, sort of fun and charming. Gabriel's also just a terrible villain. He's like, and S.I. Morales is really bad in the role. Like, it's just totally generic, like, ha ha ha, cackling.
And so it's hard to imagine who would have been good in that role aside from Philip Seymour Hoffman, who sadly has already been in the franchise and is not available.
Yes, because he's dead. But yeah, I mean, I think like S.I. Morales is awful in these movies and helps drag down a franchise that, you know, was already sort of lumbering on the weight of its own mythos. Also, I'm sorry, like, can I have a spoiler thing here? Like, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, or whatever we do for the countdown. Why don't they just like smash the drive with the entity on it at the end, right? Like, rather than entrusting it to like internet Jesus Ethan Hunt, like, shouldn't they just like trap the entity in the weird little drive and then destroy the drive?
Well, it gets into he's killing a sentient being there. I don't know. Ethan Hunt
has killed a lot of sentient beings in this franchise. Like,
that's true. That's true. No, it's funny how much the end of this resembles the Star Trek: The Next Generation episode where Moriarty comes to life. Do you guys remember that one? There's several Moriarty episodes, but yes. Well, there's an episode specifically where the holodeck creates a real life Moriarty, and they have to like trap him in a holo cube, like a holodeck cube. It's almost the same. I swear to God, it's like the same thing. Anyway, Peter, what did you make of the final reckoning?
So I'll start by saying I love this franchise. Unlike Alyssa, the franchise has not been wearing thin for me. And in fact, I thought that Dead Reckoning Part 1 was just excellent through and through. Just an absolute delight of a summer blockbuster. What pretty much like nearly exactly what I want from a franchise action film. And it's zippy. It's not self-referential. The action,
they killed Ilsa Faust, who's like one of the best parts of this franchise. They killed Ilsa Faust and replaced her with an inferior pickpocket.
Arguably a bad decision. On the other hand, I actually quite like Hayley Atwell's character in that movie, and less so in this film, just because she's separated from Cruise for so much of the movie. This film has a bunch of issues, and I this film basically has all of the problems that the previous Christopher McQuarrie, and frankly, the even before that, this film actually gets into doing the franchise crap that all of the other Mission Impossible films before it had mostly avoided in a way that I really found delightful. And the big thing that they avoided was tying the franchise together in any meaningful way, like having, like trying to make it somber and meaningful, even within the film, right? These movies were like, they were self-aware, they were light on their feet, even when they were kind of long, like Dead Reckoning Part One. What they managed to do was like, you can just go in and enjoy this for what this is. We're going to make sure that it's fun, that it's funny, that it like zips along, that there's you never go more than about 18 minutes without another pretty big, if not gigantic, action sequence. And you don't need to remember anything from any of the previous films, even if some of the characters do show up again, right? Like, it's just like, here's Tom Cruise and his gang doing crazy stuff. Jumping out, doing the Halo jump, right? Hanging off the Burj Khalifa and hanging off the C-130 cargo plane, right? There's the helicopter sequence in, I think that's number five, all right? Like, even when you have the more CG sequences, like the previous water sequence, not the submarine one in this, but like at number five or six, there's like a centrifugal water bit that's like much more computer generated. There are two things about all of those action sequences. One is that they are really well shot. The action is so perfectly clear at all times, in part because anytime they're not using CG, what they're doing is they are making sure to show you that it's Tom Cruise. And so that it's not just those sequences don't just work because you know Tom Cruise is there risking his life. They're there. They work because you can see those shots have been widened and extended, right? Like they're sort of like they let them linger in a way that you don't typically get in a big budget action film, because they're just kind of like the big budget action films these days so often just want to sort of rip through their shots and like have these cool bits until you get to like one big painterly moment, right? No, this is just all like kind of GoPro footage, right? It's like beautiful HD GoPro footage that's like Tom Cruise was here. And we're just gonna hold this shot to let you see that Tom Cruise is here, and that's really his face, and it's really that far down below him. And you can, and so these films just give you these incredible action sequences that are kind of old school, even though they are incredibly modern in the way that they are produced. They're old school in the sense that they just let you see what is happening, and they let you see what's happening to the character, and it's just a joy to watch. But then it's not just that they're shot so well, it's also that Christopher McQuarrie, going back decades, the thing that he has done better than almost anyone is he uses these action set pieces, sequences, to build tension. And it's not just that you sort of get these incredible moments of Tom Cruise hanging and you can really see that there's a whole lot of air between him and the ground. And like, man, if gravity were to happen here, he would die. No, it's also that like, McQuarrie is setting up all of these little clockwork bits so that you are thinking in the same moment that Tom Cruise is thinking, I gotta get to the other wing. I gotta get myself from here to here. I gotta make sure that this helicopter goes this direction in this canyon because I can see that cliff is that far away from me and I can see this thing is working, right? Like the tension of it is built so exquisitely. And these clockwork mechanisms are just such fun to watch because you are seeing the physical reality moment to moment, both in real life and then in narrative terms in a way that is so rare in action blockbusters.
Yes, and willing to be funny. I mean, I will say, yes, during the biplane sequence, I had this moment of just profound regret that Buster Keaton never got a chance to see this movie and be like, yeah, I will top this, right? Like, had Buster Keaton had access to the same sort of filmmaking technology and safety gear, like he and Tom Cruise would have been in just like epic stunt battle that would have ended with like both of their fiery deaths. Yeah.
The Prestige.
Yes.
Guys.
100%.
Guys, AI is going to bring back Buster Keaton. We're going to get the last Buster Keaton performance in Mission Impossible, another one.
I hate you so much. I hate the machines. I hate the entity is going to bring back Buster Keaton just to punish me for my sins and my skepticism.
the big problem with this movie is this first hour just does not do those things that that the Mission Impossible series has done well. It is incredibly self-referential. It's not building tension in sequences. It's trying to build tension for the overall plot of the film, but like that doesn't really start happening until almost literally exactly 1 hour in. This movie, it's 2 hours and 49 minutes, and it needs to be about 2 hours and five. And that whole first hour needs to be compressed into basically two bits. There's two things that need to be there, and the prologue needed to be Luther dying, yeah. Right? It's just like, start with that. Just like, that's the opening 8 minutes. And then you need a couple of, like, you need 4 or 5 minutes where you get the team together, like you get the whatever the crazy girl who they have to rescue and bring back onto the team, right? Like that scene takes 4 minutes in this movie. Have that, and then you just skip directly to the moment where the president is in the room with her team, with all of her security advisors, and they're going over the history of everything Tom Cruise has done in the movies. And they're like, it's all one guy. You start the movie at that point. That's 12 minutes in my version of the movie. And then the movie just flows from there. And it's a great 2 hour. And I don't know, maybe it's 2 hours and 12 minutes or something like that. But like, that's a tight movie that just gets to the point, because this movie just doesn't get going until almost 90 minutes in. It's like 86 or 88 minutes in when the big submarine sequence starts to happen. And that from then on, this is a great Mission Impossible movie, a little bit too somber for my tastes, but like a great Mission Impossible movie from 80 or 90 minutes in, but not a great movie in the first hour and a half.
What's interesting about this movie is that it is, you're right, Peter, it's very different from the other Mission Impossible movies. This is an idea movie. The other Mission Impossible movies have not been idea movies, right? Not movies with like a real idea at the core of them, outside of like the general idea that like Tom Cruise, Ethan Hunt, cannot treat his members as disposable because that has happened to him and he hated it, right? Like that's like the big idea of these movies. And this is a movie that has an argument to make, and as such kind of does get bogged down in that for the first hour. But I frankly love the first hour. I like the first hour more than I like the submarine bit myself. But this is one of these things where it's like, I probably just agree with the first hour a lot, like repeatedly saying that the internet is going to kill everybody and we got to stop it. I'm with you, Ethan. We got to stop the internet. Yeah. Got to get rid of it.
I do think it's really interesting to imagine what these last two movies would have been like with a sort of convincing AI doomer cult actually sort of developed. Whether you have sort of accelerationists or like some sort of, you know, I really think that Gabriel is like a huge black hole at the heart of both of these movies in a way that's kind of a bummer.
These movies have never had great villains besides Philip Seymour Hoffman in number three. And he took an extremely underwritten part and just played the hell out of it because he was Philip Seymour Hoffman and could play the hell out of absolutely anything. I think there is a little bit of, I don't want to say scaredness, but Tom Cruise has never, it really, like it's in the modern era, has not loved being pitted against a villain, an actor who can hold his own against him on screen. And the other thing we know, I mean, this is reported in the Journal. It's also in some of the commentary tracks on the somewhat underrated fourth one, the Burj Khalifa Ghost Protocol. Maybe my favorite of the Mission Impossible movies. But like one thing we know about these films is they basically play in the action sequences and then after the fact try to come up with a plot to tie them together. This seems kind of insane to me. Like maybe you do that once because you had to, but they just kept doing it as far as I can tell. And the result is that this time I think it didn't fully work.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning? Peter.
I really liked the back half. I don't know. I'll give it a thumbs up because once you get to the good stuff, it's pretty great.
Alyssa.
I'm going to be sort of cranky and say thumbs down. It just didn't really work for me.
Thumbs up. Good. First hour, best hour of this movie. I would go and watch it again just for that first hour.
This might be your worst opinion.
Leave and come back for the first hour all over again. Oh. Great. That is it for this week's episode of Across the Movie Aisle. Many thanks to our producer, Rupert Manishnam, without whom this program would sound much worse. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyMunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.